Hello and welcome to what is the 72nd episode of the Adoption and Fostering Podcast with me, Al Coates, and him,
Scott Carson Rennie.
Well, that's a bit dumb.
Does that sound exciting enough?
Yeah, come on, do it a bit more vim and vigour.
Oh, sorry, I'll just...
Forget it.
I'm just getting you back for the last time.
Yeah, you are. You're not bitter at all. No. Are you okay? Because I know you've been very busy.
I have. Yeah, it's very busy. I flew back from my weekend away to Toronto overnight last night. So I've had 3 hours sleep. I've worked all day today. I've just done a first and my last live Q&A for Adoption UK, because obviously tomorrow is my last day at Adoption UK. So it's a busy week.
So I've got some things you need to do, right? The first thing is you need to get perishable food and hide it in the office.
Yeah, like prawns and salmon.
Yeah, prawns, stuff. Things yeah. like that. That's just that's a sort of
behind the blinds and people's drawers.
Yeah, really.
Cupboards.
Yeah, and they'll never forget you and never invite you back. That's really inappropriate.
Yeah, thanks for that.
Yeah, no, I did that. I'll tell you the story.
I might need a job at some point. Can you imagine that in the reference?
Yes.
He left prawns in the curtains. Yeah.
I once worked in a van, in a band, and we had two, well, it was a long story. We had two vehicles, and it was shared between two teams. And one team, who we felt unjustly, were given the new van, and we were given the old van. And there was a great deal of unrest in what was meant to be a charity full of good ethos and values. And so we secretly hid ham sandwiches in the heating and air ducts, and we bathed in the warm glow of revenge, basically.
Oh my goodness.
Not proud.
Yeah.
Anyway, we've got a guest.
Yeah, we have. Sitting here in the background laughing at our inane banter.
Or maybe she's just laughing as she sees her career slowly going down the tube. Damn it. Why did I agree to this? Why?
They're always told me about frigging kippers under the bonnet in someone's wedding car, so I think that's a way to go.
Isn't it?
That's a whole new level. Anyway, you know, we have to imagine you're not here and you haven't heard that. We'd need to be professional.
Anyway,
so, Scott, I was looking, and you know, the very second guest we ever had on our third ever podcast was Helen Bonick.
No way!
Is that right?
We haven't introduced you.
So I was the first guest over two episodes.
Yes.
I was the first guest. And then Helen was the third guest. Was that the second guest? Is that?
That's right.
Is that real? Is that true? Is that a true story?
That is true. That was October 2016.
Oh, and I wasn't even there for that interview, was I?
You weren't. No. So there you go.
I think I was still negotiating my contract at that point.
Yeah. I think you were referenced. See?
Yeah. Oh, maybe.
Excellent. So anyway, Helen Bonick. Hello, Helen Bonick.
Bruce. Yeah. It's good to see you.
Hello. Thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here.
Excellent.
You say that.
Well, Helen, every time I've seen you, so this is why we've got you on, lots of good reasons, but every time I see you and I bump into you in various places and various guises and various roles, and you keep saying, I say to you, how's your book going? And you're going, it's going well. And then out of the blue, it appeared. I finally got a copy of your book, which is Child to Parent Violence and Abuse, A Practitioner's Guide to Working with Families, and it's released and it's available through, there's a Luminate.
But it's part of Pavilion, so most people will know them as Pavilion.
Pavilion, yes, I do know Pavilion. So, Helen, you've written a book. Hello.
Hello.
Well done, you, because it's a cracking book. So, that's our legal obligations fulfilled. Great book. Buy it. We'll put a picture
of it. I've not read it, so I can't say that, but because I didn't get a copy. But equally, it's not a picture book, so...
Well,
I have issues with that, apparently.
I know. We'll not pick on you today. So, Helen, tell me, why did you write the book? And is it the book that you wanted it to be?
I wrote the book because it was a topic that I couldn't put down. And for probably 8 years, maybe... while I've been developing my understanding and my knowledge of the issues, people have been saying to me, you should write a book.
Yeah.
Because there was an awareness that I was interested in what was going on and how to help people from practitioners as well as academics and families that were affected as well. So for all that time, I've been talking to different people in different places. And I really love writing, and I wanted to do something. And so it's been emerging for a very long time. It's probably, I started writing it probably about 5 years ago, and tore up loads of versions of it because it wasn't how I wanted it to be. And then it kind of started emerging probably 18 months ago properly. And we did a presentation at Community Care Live.
Yeah.
And it was a really interesting framework. And I thought that will work. That will be a way that I can say what I want to say. And it will be interesting, hopefully, and coherent. And I wanted, above all, I wanted it to be accessible and to be very practical. So I think it meets those aims. It doesn't have pictures. Thank you, Scott.
But it does have, that wasn't a criticism. It wasn't a criticism.
It has a picture on the front, which I'm very proud of, and it explains right at the back why I chose that picture, because that's it. It felt, when I found that image to start with, it was very reminiscent of kind of the brain, really, and the way things are very connected, but also a sense that as we drill down, we have a very small focus of things that seem very clear, but actually there's a lot that we still don't know. So kind of the edges, the periphery of our understanding is still very unclear. We are aware that we're still learning a lot, and there are many people that can teach us more.
So that was rather cunning, because now it means I have to take a photograph of the cover and put it on the page. And now, so you've done your media training, haven't you? They told you cunning ways of getting the men draws back the book. I'm so cynical, but you're so young.
Oh dear.
I'm kind of imagining some people, I guess I take for granted that people know what we're actually talking about when we talk about CPV, child parent violence. So I kind of thought, well, I don't want to presume that, because actually, as much as there is a lot in certain communities, there's a good understanding. Some people who are listening to this podcast may not know. So when you talk about child to parent violence, like what do you mean? What are you talking about? What, describe the phenomena.
Okay, so generally speaking, we're talking about behaviour that is more than just tantrums in a younger child, or what you might think of as normal teenage stroppiness. So we're talking about things that are more extreme, that happen over and over again. So you've got maybe a pattern of things getting more and more serious, to the extent that parents or carers will feel quite afraid of the situation, afraid of that child and what they might do. So it might be words that are used, but in a form of a kind of emotional torture. Even some people would describe it as like torture, that they're being pounded by really hateful words over a long period of time. So it might be verbal abuse, it might be physical abuse, so punching and hitting, pushing down the stairs, breaking limbs even. It might be financial abuse, so stealing things or using money, running up debts. Some families, there will be quite elements of coercion and control, but it also involves children perhaps making threats against them, set their own life or to harm themselves. It might involve them going out and parents not knowing where they are. It might involve threats to members of the family. So it's a whole raft of behaviours that fall outside of what we might normally expect within a normal family, where you have ups and downs and everyone has to deal with a bit of aggro. To the extent that people feel, as I said, afraid, and has a real impact on the family life and on the mental health and physical health, even of all those that are concerned. So lots of people talk about it feeling very like intimate partner violence.
Yeah.
There are lots of things that are different about that, but that people describe it in that way, and that perhaps gives a sense of the extreme nature of what we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, it covers such a broad range of behaviour, and it's really hard to, isn't it? That's one of the issues I think you identify in the book, isn't it? How do you define it? And does that definition then impact on how people either include themselves in that world or not? Do you think that the definition is important, or is it not that important?
We haven't got an agreed definition, and that's part of the issue. I think that it's very difficult to talk as a community even about what we're talking about, because we can't necessarily agree. And it means that many parents won't have heard of what they're going through. They won't have heard it talked about, perhaps, so they won't have had a name for it. So they might just see it as a bit of extra aggro, or they might, it might have become so normalised that they think that it's just part of life and you have to put up with it. Or quite often parents will feel that they assume that they're the only person that that's happening to. They won't know anyone else it's happening to. So they're quite ashamed of what's going on, maybe, or don't know even where to go for help. So not having a definition or a name is quite a problem. And I've counted loads and loads of different names, and you'll have other names as well of what we're talking about. So there's no real agreement how we talk about it.
See,
the definition thing for me is quite an issue, because you mentioned a lot of things there that aren't, when we think of the word violence, that kind of makes us think of a physical kind of a thing, doesn't it, rather than a kind of, you know, like you say, financial, verbal, all that sort of stuff. So Al has used a different acronym in the past, but it's quite a long one, so I can't remember what it is, whereas child and parent violence seems to be kind of, you know, not descriptive of it, but it kind of sums it up in some ways, doesn't
Gets
it?
To the point.
Yeah.
Point. But more recently I've started saying child to parent violence and abuse, because some people felt that it excluded them if just talking about violence. And every family will experience it differently. So some families will have different elements and not others.
Yeah.
So it's very unique in each situation.
Yeah.
But also, I guess I think the reason for me coming from a slightly different angle is that it's not just parents, is it? It's carers, and it's adoptive parents, and it's family members. Yeah. Is that, am I just semantics?
I suppose I've always used the word parent, because for me that encapsulated anyone in a parenting role. So as you said, foster parents, adoptive parents, grandparents who are parenting a child, because I suppose for me parenting involved those elements of nurture and care and teaching, if you like, as well, and that's inside that kind of sense of parenting. But I know that some people feel excluded by that term. So anybody that is in with that role, and that will include people within residential care as well, because we know it's quite a big issue within residential care.
And siblings. Sorry.
And siblings. So.
Oh yes.
Yeah. It's a whole separate pieces of research, sibling abuse and sibling violence, isn't there? But I think it's important to recognise that within what we're talking about, that there's a lot. Not just collateral damage, but very deliberate harm to siblings as well.
So, do we know, I mean, in terms of causes of that, I mean, I can guess what the causes would be, but, you know, what have you found are the underlying causes for this kind of, these kind of behaviours? And I say behaviours with, I don't like using that word, but you know what I'm trying to say. What's the underlying causes of it?
What's been interesting is that I've kind of dipped in and out of lots of different communities, if you like, while I've been doing my writing and researching and campaigning. So it's been great to get to know people within the adoption community, and lots of you folks will have had experience where children have had early trauma. So looking at the reasons why children have come into care in the first place and then been placed for adoption, then often there is issues there that have had a lasting impact on how children understand themselves or how they relate to the world. So that for adoptive families, there's all that going on. There's loss, there's trauma. But not all families who experience violence and abuse from their children are in that position. Some will have been through, perhaps experienced domestic abuse themselves. So there's maybe, if you look at all the research that we have, maybe half of those families will have experienced domestic abuse. And those children who then have gone on to use abuse themselves. But that's not necessarily because that's what they've seen and they just think that's the right way to behave. For some of those young people, maybe that is the case. They've just seen that it gets, you know, that's the way to get what you want. But in other situations, it will be very different. So it might be about an absent parent still coaching a child to behave in that way, or it might be a child who now feels very frustrated or angry because their parent, within their living now, wasn't able to protect them. Or it might be that that parent is now very depressed and the young person feels that they have to fill a role, fill a void in the family, a role they're not able to do. So that would be another group of situations, if you like, where we would be experiencing seeing violence and abuse. There are also, as I've got to know people whose children have neurodevelopmental disorders, so there would be issues there around regulation of mood and emotion and behaviour and not being able to cope perhaps with the frustration or the confusion, particularly things going on at school, and then you come home and then it all explodes at home. So then you've got children who have mental health issues, you've got children who have physical health issues, you've got children who have experienced later loss or substance abuse. There's so many different things that are going on, and often those are on top of each other as well, just to add to the confusion. So I do say you can see some patterns, but every family, we need to ask what's going on for you, what might be the behind that. Some of those things you might be able to bring about a resolution quite quickly, particularly if families seek help quite early on. But other of those issues are going to be much more harder to work with and will need much more longer-term support.
That's really interesting, because I think that one of the things I like about your book is it feels really grounded in reality of... It's not sort of a book saying, oh, I've got this sorted. Oh, it's very much there's a sense of there's a whole host of reasons why it could be happening or that have drawn to this point. And you, one of your chapters is entitled sort of Difficult Parents or you know, this idea of sorry, I forgot the title. I can't find the thing. But this idea of practitioners... I couldn't find the contents page. This idea of practitioners coming into a house and saying, is this the child or is this the parent?
And Who are we going to blame in this?
Yeah. I thought that was really interesting that you drew that out, because that's rarely a conversation that I see people having so overtly. So what is going on in practitioners' heads when they walk into a house and you've got this situation?
Well, I wouldn't like to speak for everybody. One thing I do make clear in the book is that I know of, and I know there are many practitioners who've got this really nailed and know what's going on and are really doing really good practice. Mm-hmm. And I think I want to avoid saying it's all hopeless. There's, you know, no one knows what to do. You're doomed. Because I know that there is really good practice. So I want to celebrate that as well, if you like. And that's hard. That's hard. If you're a family who's not able to find someone that can help you, that's really hard for me to hear me say that. I acknowledge that. What's happening when a worker goes into a family? I think we're used to thinking in particular frameworks according to our job. And if you're a child protective social worker, then the usual framework that you're looking at is what's going on in this family, what are the issues that mean this child is at risk, how can I strengthen what's going on in the family in order to provide protection and safety for that child particularly. Yeah. So it does turn on it on the head, the way that we usually think about things, and that's been a problem for many practitioners, because it just turns everything upside down when we're not used to thinking about power coming from the child to the adult. We're used to thinking in the other way.
Get
your head around. It takes some thinking about, and it takes a while to acknowledge that what looks superficially perhaps like something that you used to is actually something very different.
Because I know that I'm relatively newly qualified. And our focus is on listening to children, believing children, protecting children, and all of those are good things. All of those are right things. But and I'm not saying we shouldn't do those things, but often going into a situation, there's perhaps another narrative.
I've been doing some more research recently, and what's been interesting to me as I've gone back through writing about safeguarding, about child protection, is all the way through it, there is an emphasis on understanding the child within the family and not just looking at keeping the child safe in isolation. And I think it's fascinating that what I and other people are saying now is we have to look at the whole family. You have to understand the child in a relationship. You have to be working with relationships if we're to bring about change. That's what we're saying now in relation to this, and that's, people have been saying that for years and years and years, but somehow we've kind of lost that that understanding. We've kind of got so focused down on the child that we've missing the other things that are going on.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot. It is I find it a fascinating subject, and like you said, that I resist the temptation of thinking we're all doomed, because actually there are, you meet professionals who are really quite insightful. And I remember at the event we spoke about when I was like your sidekick, because you were the main show, you were very good. But I asked a question, who here, in a room of 200 plus social workers, who here has been, works with children who are sometimes violent to their parents? And everyone put their hand up, and obviously they'd come because that was the name of the subject, so it was not that stupid. But then I asked who here has been trained, and I think I could count on one hand the number of people. Are you seeing, do you think there's a change, and that was 2 years ago, so have you seen a change in the number of people who are being trained? Is there an increased awareness? Are we moving in the right direction?
What I'm conscious of is conferences going around the country within local authorities. So there is certainly awareness raising going on. And I know of individuals who are on the training circuit, if you like, who are working with some local authorities. And I know of people who head up programs and they're being asked to go and speak in different places. Whether we're still in an echo chamber, I don't know, and we're speaking to people who are already doing that work rather than broadening the reach, that I don't know. I'm hopeful. I am very hopeful. I think there's a real a broadening of the reach, if you like, because it's being talked about now in so many places, with stuff on the radio, stuff on the television, episode of Whole City last week, you know, in lots of places now people are talking about this, making it much more easy to talk about, and I am hopeful. I think there is more awareness going on. I can't speak for the actual how much practitioners have been trained. I don't know. I'm hopeful, but I don't know.
But anecdotally, do you think there's a difference? Do you think that it's moving in the right direction? I'm trying to squeeze you there.
Anecdotally, yes. Okay, I'm going to say yes, because I'm ever hopeful.
Excellent.
Well, I mean, I think we could all be hopeful. I think the point, well, no, I don't have an issue with it per se, but I think it's one of those things that's really hard to provide training on, because, you know, reflecting back on what you just said earlier about the fact that every family is different, the reasons for it are all different. So how, you know, I guess I'm just a little bit wary of, you know, when we talk about training for this kind of thing, I guess the training needs to be a little bit, and you'll have to excuse me while I find my words in my head, because my jet lag has kicked in the last half hour. But, you know, when we think about what's going on there, it's more about the practical stuff that we can do when it's happening than the lead up to it, because I know how to deal with it in our family based on the relationship I have with my children. Yeah. But equally, my husband equally has to deal with things differently, because his personality is different, his approach is different. So I get all that. I'm just saying I'm a little bit concerned that perhaps there's some kind of providers who might be saying that they're going to provide the solution to this, and I think that would be nigh on impossible. But, you know, I'm not sure if I'm on my own in that.
I think if we imagine a world where you could walk into a family and you could hold up a paper bag and say, here you are, open it, and that's the solution, that would be a complete mistake. We can't be in that position. Yeah. But we can be in a position where we're saying to practitioners, these are the sorts of issues that might be behind something. Go and get to know the family. Go and listen to the family. Yeah. Hear what use their expertise. Work alongside them in partnership with them, if you like. Mm. Help as a team to divide, find things that work. Build on strengths. Build up support networks. Help that family to access every bit of support there is out there. And these are some things that also work. So it's not about... What worries me is that people will buy my book thinking it's going to be a holding hands and you have to do step one, then you move on to step two, step three. It's not that sort of book. It's a book which talks you through lots and lots of the issues, asks questions, challenges you about the way you're thinking, and then says, look, these are the fundamental things that you need to understand about this issue, and these are the sorts of ways that you can help bring about support in families. But it's about understanding the expertise the family brings as well.
Mm.
So does that feel more comfortable?
Well, it does, but it's just the three of us. I'm just worried about what's out there in the big wide world.
You do name some specific models or interventions, you know, NVR, nonviolent resistance, break for change, respect, all things that we've probably heard of Step Up, which is also a social worker, and Who's in Charge. I mean, are they...
There are all programs which have had, which have proved to be, have promising results, if you like.
Right.
But they also need to be based within probably longer term support. So it might be that somebody's supporting a family and they say, look, I've heard of this program and it seems like it would be really effective for you at the moment. Go along, but we're going to carry on supporting you in that period, and we're going to support you afterwards. It's not something, they're not something that you can say, go on this 12-week program and everything's going to be hunky-dory after that. They introduce structured ways of thinking, they ask challenging questions, they encourage both young people and parents to take responsibility, see where that's appropriate. They find other ways of doing other things, other ways of communication. So they've all got really strong positives, but they're not going to be effective on their own. We have to acknowledge that most families will need ongoing support for some time, and that there are some families where things are really extreme, and actually what the only way to make everybody safe is perhaps for that child to be removed for a while. And that might mean going into care, it might mean going into hospital, it might mean going to live somewhere else, going into a residential school perhaps. And that is when things are really, really bad, and we need to just keep everybody safe. And we hope that will just be for a while, but we know that, you know, we've got these programs, they seem to be promising, but they're not the be-all and end-all. We have to look at each situation.
And of course, with the different kind of backgrounds as well, because I tweeted actually earlier that we were talking to you tonight, and the irony was I was watching an episode of Holby City from last week where it was a mother and daughter, biological mother and daughter, and she had experienced this kind of thing from her daughter. And of course, we have access. I mean, I say we have access, you know, we are on a list somewhere in terms of trying to achieve support. But of course, there's families out there who actually won't be on these lists, who are actually experiencing this and thinking like I did maybe 5 years ago, that this was unusual. It was something that only we were experiencing. But we could access elements of support and understanding, which has grown in time, which is fantastic. But of course, you've got these biological families who are going through this as well, and they're not able to get what we can get.
Yeah. And that's when I think we're really pleased to see that awareness has grown amongst the practitioners. So depending where you live, you might be able to go to, you might be able to get help from CAMHS. You might be able to get help from your local domestic abuse agency. You might be able to get help from youth offending team or from children's services. Where you get help from might be very different wherever you live, but there might well be someone locally that is aware of this, and you can dip into their help. Lots of people getting help through schools these days. There's often either social workers or family workers based in schools, and a growing awareness there as well, I think.
One of the things I found, I was invited to come and speak to a group of parents who were, there was a real broad range of people. So there was all, you know, biological parents, kinship carers, adoptive parents, foster carers. But the common denominator was sort of violent, aggressive behaviour. And one of the key things that I think universally everyone said was this real nervousness about speaking to social care. And is that, I mean, was that just that group? Because they were, again, they represented a whole demographic of kind of social status and employment, income, all the kind of things. But that was the one theme. Is that something that you've seen?
Certainly. If you go online on message boards, all over message boards, you'll get, don't call social care, it'll be terrible, this is what they'll do. And that's it is a fear for parents, and sadly that fear has some reality, that there has been some bad practice. But also, we were saying earlier that part of the issue is that social workers are trained to look and think in a particular way, and we're bringing an issue that turns that up on its head. And so there is a risk that social workers might make assumptions about something that's happening that isn't. But we do know that there are social workers that are doing really great jobs. And this is, particularly with teenagers, you know, there's been for a long time, there's been people working with what they've called teenagers on the edge of care. And in some ways, this is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
We are used to working in this field. We've just understood it and thought about it and called it something different. And we might want to bring in new ways of working as well as we broaden and deepen understanding. But people do have anxieties, and sadly sometimes that is based in truth. But it is still important that people know that might be the appropriate place to go, if depending on the kind of help you want.
Yeah. And do you think that are people, did you speak to different sort of professions? Because obviously your background is social work, you've been a social worker, practice educator. What about other services? How is it perceived by other agencies or groups of professionals?
So the Youth Offending Service are also very familiar with what's going on. But within many professions, people have come across it almost by accident. So they've been working around with a family about different things, or with a young person about different things, and then suddenly they've kind of tripped over this, that parents have started saying, I can't get him to school. I can't get him out of bed in the morning. I can't get him to school. And because of that, none of my other kids are going to school either, or we're all terrified of what's going on. And suddenly someone says, well, why can't you get him out of bed? Why can't you get him to school?
Yeah.
And suddenly understanding, actually, this is something, it's not just a child who's being awkward. It's not just a child who's, it's not a child who's phobic or afraid of school, but actually this is a parent who genuinely is very afraid of what might happen if they physically tried to get that child out of bed and put them in the car. So we've tripped over it. So schools workers often have a growing understanding of what it might mean, because they've started talking to parents about why is this child not in school. They've listened to the family story. They've started meeting with the young person. And a growing understanding there within all sorts of places that families might go for help, as professionals start to really genuinely listen and then to start asking questions, people are finding out more and understanding more. And I can't understand how, I can't remember how that question started.
It's just about how different groups of professionals perceive it.
I think it's understood in slightly different ways, probably, isn't it? That that sometimes it's conceptualized in a different way, perhaps as bad behavior or unwell behavior, or depending on what your professional background is, you may kind of conceptualize it in a different way.
I was thinking as well about the age of children, because I know that there's the 2014 Home Office guidance, adolescent to parent, and which I think you were part of, which is actually really good. And if anyone is struggling with their children, I'd say that's a really good place to start. And it's short, isn't it? Print it off and take it to a meeting. But it's adolescent. And do you think
it's adolescent at that time? That was what we were thinking of. That's what we were thinking. In the lead up to writing that, people weren't really aware that this was an issue for younger children as well. It was seen as kids are turning teenagers, and lots of reasons why things might happen at that age. But there wasn't really very much understanding that it was an issue for families with younger children as well. And we are now seeing that, and we're now understanding that, and we're now broadening the range of understanding and help available. But yeah, so that's why a lot of the papers still talk about adolescents, parent violence, rather than children. I think I like to use child because it accepts that the age is going to be much lower. The age range that referrals are being made to teams for help, for requesting help, that's getting lower and lower. So from primary school to age as well.
So that's encouraging, really, isn't it? I mean, it's not encouraging. It was in the sense that we're realising the scope of it, but the fact that people are increasingly comfortable to sort of say, that's my story, and my child is 9 or 7 or even younger.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that people often say. You get all the headlines, it's doubling in 3 years, was one of the recent ones. And how do we understand statistics, and should we be pleased that the numbers are going up, or should we be despairing that numbers are going up? But I think the fact that people are recognising that it's an issue and feel able to name it, feel able to claim that this is what's happening to them, that should be seen as a good thing. The recording is getting better, so we have better statistics. We still don't have, because we haven't got a name, code. If you haven't got a code, you can't count it. But that, things like that are getting better. We know that there are police forces now that are recognising it as a separate issue and are counting it specifically. So that's good, even if it makes it look like it's getting worse.
Yeah, a friend of mine made a comparison between she'd worked with domestic violence and intimate partner violence in the 80s, and she said it feels like she said the comparison, it feels very like a very similar time, whereas a lot of people knew it was happening, a lot of professionals, but had limited tools or limited understanding, and would often sort of couch it in terms of, well, if you were a better parent, like, or you were a better wife, you know, kind of thinking historically. And she said it feels like we're at that tipping point where it becomes common knowledge, and professionals then start to ask better questions.
Yeah, I think so. But also alongside that goes lots of blame from the wider community as well, doesn't it? That those who are around early on within domestic abuse will remember the extent to which people didn't really accept what was going on and blamed it must be the woman's fault, she didn't try hard enough, she didn't do as she was asked. I think we're still getting, to some extent, that sort of attitude within some people.
So you were on Radio Kent last week and you made a comment which kind of referenced people's attitudes. And you mentioned how all the contributors had said one thing, but everyone, there was a lot of other people, callers coming in. So explain your tweet.
I'm trying to remember what the detail was. I'm trying to remember the exact detail. So there was, they were interviewing one guy, weren't they, who was basically saying that really what had happened was we weren't allowed to spank children anymore, and that was the cause of the decline in behaviour in the home and in society as a whole, was down to parents not being allowed to smack their children anymore. And it was really interesting. When he started saying it, I was like, oh, crumbs, now what have we got here? How are we going to work with this? But what was really encouraging was that every single other person that was interviewed, very gently often, but had an answer for that and was talking about how maybe that wasn't very helpful, actually, and what did that actually teach children, and that... Yeah, that wasn't the route we wanted to go down. That actually, the fact that we'd been spanked or people spanked in the past maybe hadn't created the sort of society that we wanted, and it wasn't quite as happy as we all would like to think it was. But this certainly wasn't the answer for children who had experienced trauma, who had other issues going for them. That actually they required a different. Some people would say a gentler kind of parenting, a more compassionate kind of parenting, one that was more directed to their specific needs.
Excellent. Because we've talked quite a while, so I don't want to exhaust you, but one of the last chapter is the last chapter is one thing everyone can do. So what is that one thing? Because I thought that was really helpful just to... to actually say that there is something you can do, because you know you say it's not a practical book on, you know, five steps to transforming lives, but you do highlight some stuff.
Well, what I wanted to make it was a book that would be helpful for anybody, whether they were helping a friend or whether they were I don't know, someone in a school, someone in a GP surgery, someone in a church even, someone who was working with children's services, wherever you work, something in there that would be helpful for you. And obviously different people in different places there are different levels of complexity about what's expected, aren't they?
Yeah.
But even as a friend, without training, without resources, there is something that everyone can do, and that is to listen. And I think it struck me when I was talking to people, talking to families, and saying what would be the one thing that you would say to people. That was what came across as the most important thing: listening to someone, genuinely giving the person to hear their story and hear what they're saying.
That's a really great message. The idea that actually listening is a really great start point, whether you're an auntie, an uncle, a mum or a dad, or a neighbour, or a social worker, or a police officer, or whatever. That listening message is essential. But I have a question. What are you doing next, Helen?
So I've been asked to write a chapter in a book about child protection. That's what I'm doing at the moment. And that's what I'm doing at the moment. But also I'm going on tour. A couple of universities have asked me to come and do evening seminars, so I'm going to wander around the country with me with a bag of books and see if I can sell a few more.
Excellent.
Just talk about raising awareness, promoting the understanding. That's what I'm doing at the moment. Yeah,
that's wonderful.
Thank you.
Well, what we'll do is we shall put this on, this will come up on the podcast. We'll put a link to your book, which is we do get sent a lot of books, and there's a lot of books that I would not necessarily buy. I get sent a lot of books. I make sure Scott doesn't get them. But this is one book. I know it's quite an expensive book, but it feels like it's actually... It's probably the book that I would recommend, even if I would say buy it. If it's something that you work with, or even if for a parent, actually, I think it's really helpful. Because what I thought as a parent, you would read that and you would kind of go, this explains why people talk to me like this, or this explains why my social worker doesn't believe me. And it gives people sort of the opportunity to step around some of that stuff and kind of maybe intervene in some of that stuff in their own life. So I would recommend it.
Great to hear that you have those thoughts.
Thank you. Yeah. Cool. So Helen, thank you very much. It's been lovely to chat to you. And Scott, you can go off now to your slumber.
Yes, and I am off to my slumber as well.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it. Okay. And yeah, it's good to speak to you guys again.
Yeah, look after yourself.
Thanks, Helen.
Okay, cheerio.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.